Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off! We're off! Here we go. We cut right in there. And this is a really special day, guys. There's a lot going on. Natalie is away.
Yes.
So while the cat's away, Natalie is the cat. The mice, me and Nathaniel, will play a couple of songs and mainly chat about stuff.
Try our best.
We've got Irene in charge this week, and she's already nailed it. We're already 2 hours ahead of schedule because we're recording at midday.
Which is the time it goes out.
Which is the time it goes out. We're now exactly 48 hours.
In your futures.
Is it 48? It's not.
It will be.
It's not. It's 72, isn't it?
Nah, because it's Wednesday, Friday.
Thursday, Friday. Yeah, we're 48 hours.
We're 48 hours in your future. We know what's going to happen.
In the past.
You're in the past. We're the future, mate.
We are ghosts of the past. 48 hours in the past telling you it's been all right. I mean, it's very useless hearing ghosts from the past, isn't it? Because they can't tell you about anything that's coming up.
No, and it just means that all we can tell you is things that happened 2 days ago. And I haven't even seen the news to tell you.
Oh, let's stay away from the news today. Fuck me. What a cunt. So, here we go.
I don't know what you mean.
One minute into the show, and we're already dropping clangers left, right, and centre.
Wow, I've missed some news.
But this is 48 hours in your past. In your past. If you're listening to it live, and it's actually probably more likely that you're listening to it as a podcast, which means that, fuck.
I can't work out for everyone, guys.
The last 2 minutes has been a waste of everyone's time.
Including ours.
But what is it if not a waste of time? And
we're here to waste your time.
I was, and also the other thing we're celebrating right now is Malta is back.
Oh yeah,
183 on the Maltese charts.
It does specifically say comedy, so it might be in the Maltese comedy chart.
Maybe comedy charts. Maybe that's where we are. I don't think that we are trying to be funny. It's weird that. We are comedians, but there's more to us than that. I was in a restaurant.
A little
Vietnamese place that I've never been to before on Shaftesbury Avenue.
Lovely.
I went to see some comedy. I went to see Phil Ellis.
Oh yeah,
at the Soho Theatre. Because I like Phil. Phil's brilliant. Anyway, we're in this Vietnamese restaurant, and I was there with my friend Joe DaCosta, former fan club clubhouse member, and we were sat next to this couple that were on a date, and they were talking about stuff that they like doing. Oh God! And first dates are very difficult, and it's a case of sort of like, oh, I don't know. It was impossible not to really hear.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to really listen in, but it's just like, it's one of those things where it's not, my ears aren't traveling to them. Their voices are traveling to my ears. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And it was, you know, but he was like, talking about, and I don't want to say talking about, that sounds like he was going into some depth. He wasn't. I just heard him say, podcast mainly. like to expand my mind. And I like to think that's the sort of thing that we're offering people. It's more than comedy. We're expanding people's minds.
Yeah. It's clever comedy. It's funny, but you're learning something as well.
It's clever comedy because it's not necessarily funny.
Yeah.
I think a lot of comedy these days is very clever.
Yes.
That's right. Alternative to comedy.
Be too clever.
Just want to say, this is a shout out to all the comedians out there, because I know you're listening. there's one thing comedians are famous for, is supporting each other's podcast. just keep up the good work, guys. We're almost out of the woodwork. So,
out of the woodwork.
So, we're like little wood lice. went to see Phil Ellis yesterday because my girlfriend is in the show. No, not because my girlfriend is in the show, but went to see it.
Oh, is it like a play? Is it?
Reason? No. Well, it's sort of like, it's funny. It's the sort of thing that would be very easy to do in Edinburgh.
Right.
Because there's comedians everywhere.
Everyone's there, yeah.
And you just get a bunch of people to just help out. But when it actually comes to touring, it's like, oh, this is impossible. Why did I do this? I always found that when I was doing Edinburgh shows, when I'd sort of like get David Trent and Chris Boyd to do music stuff, they'd be in my band, and then you'd go, oh, but how do we tour it? And it's like, oh, God, you've got to not only make enough money for you, but you've got to make enough money to make it worthwhile for the people that are touring with you. And so these things are sort of don't really work eventually. But unless you're just, I mean, with sketch groups, if there's four people in the sketch group, they tend to get paid the same amount as a solo act.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
So you're splitting everything four ways plus travel. It's a fucking brutal industry, isn't it? Anyway, Phil Ellis was on, and all of his, he had a bunch of other people that were in the show, but it was great. It was at the Soho Theatre. I've already seen something else at the Soho. I saw Sunil Patel at the Soho Theatre. And he was really great, but that was months ago now. It's good space, but it was really good because the way it is the stuff that happens where, oh no, the show doesn't go to plan. It's like a biography. It's like a biopic of his life, but it doesn't go quite to plan and then stuff. But there was genuine stuff that was kicking off yesterday and stuff that was planned and stuff that was meant to be planned but didn't go right. And so there's like five elements at play. That some of it was deliberate and some of it wasn't. And because, you know, whenever it's just like, oh no, we're on the wrong page in the script, and you go, well, that's planned. And then it turned out that some of that wasn't planned.
And then the audience are probably going, that's meant to happen.
Yeah, but the audience are going, yeah, yeah, right. So that was the thing. It was just like, well, this is definitely, you know, they're comedians, right? They're not... you know, there's a lot of acting involved in comedy, but I'm just like saying comedians, sometimes their acting isn't as subtle and oh no, this is going badly. So it's like signposted a little bit, you know, and you kind of like going, oh, it's going, do you know what I mean?
Mm.
It's sort of like a heavy handedness to accidental mistakes that are, you know, as part of a show. But it turned out that some of them were real. And then there was stuff that was so subtle that was all deliberate and planned. And yeah, it was just this absolutely amazing. It's not a car crash because it was just really well. It was just really good. It was just a really entertaining night. And it was kind of like he's sort of a master of, I say he's a master of chaos. But like one, you know, I relate a lot to what he does because, there are sort of like elements that he does that that I do, and then you look at it and you kind of like go, oh wow, yeah, I really love that and I like that, and it's sort of as a completely unique individual comedian like myself, it's very rare to find another act that ticks all the boxes that you look for in something, and Phil really does that for me.
And when you do, he's ripped you off. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, he's ripped me off. No, well, I've got to Always Be Comedy on tomorrow night, which is yesterday night for all you listeners, down in Kennington. And the last time I did it was just before...
Oh, it's in person. It's not online.
No, I'm doing it. I'm doing an actual... I'm turning up in person. Wow. I'm doing it. And the last time I did Always Be Comedy, I think, was in February or March 2020. And the lineup was me... Johnny Vegas and Phil Ellis, and it was like, what do you mean diversity? It's like,
you've probably not a great booking policy.
you booked three identical acts, right? And then what was good about it was when you put us all next to each other, you can see how different we are.
Right.
But on paper, it's like, yeah, three guys that have a breakdown. yeah, and I remember they phoned up and they said, right, Phil is closing. Would you like to go on before or after Johnny Vegas? And you go, well, before.
But then it's weird that Johnny Vegas is like the middle act.
Phil was headlining. Johnny Vegas, I think, was sort of like dropping by to do new material. And then it's like, well, they don't have an opener. And I was like, well, I'll do it. If I can be on a bill with them two.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, that's what I was being offered. I'm not like, I'll only do it if I headline. But it's also, do I want to be on after Johnny Vegas?
Yeah.
No. Because he can, you know... He can go either way, right? And regardless of what he does on stage, you kind of like don't want to be on. You want a nice interval afterwards.
Yeah. I can't remember. I was listening to something recently and they were talking about in the, I guess, 90s, early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, Lee Evans would show up at glee clubs.
Right.
He'd always do the middle spot. And then he'd basically do like, because he'd be coming on doing like a warm up for his tour or something. He'd go out. Everyone usually knew he was coming, like it was rumoured. And so there was a bit of a, yeah, it's Lee Evans is on. Or it was even on a mailing list, maybe saying Lee Evans is on in the middle. And he'd be on in the middle so as not to try and like, so he could still have a comedy night around it. So basically, you'd have an opening act. Lee Evans would do his tour show in the middle. So rather than 20 minutes, we'd end up doing like an hour and a half. And then there'd be a break, and then you'd have a headliner come out, and all the audience had left.
But that's also the thing, isn't it? Because when Johnny does 20, he does 40. And
yeah.
It's kind of like, why would you want to follow that?
Yeah.
Lee Evans, that's one of the things. Lee Evans retired, didn't he? Like not that long ago, 5 years ago, maybe.
Mm.
And I just remember it was like he was getting ready for his final tour. And you'd see just comedians like posting pictures on Facebook, guys. And it was all kind of like, oh, I've just gigged with Lee Evans. And it was kind of like, well, will I be at a gig, I wonder, where Lee Evans is... No. Well, I wasn't. But, it was like one of those things where you kind of like go, oh, my God, this is an absolute megastar who's popping up and doing these like little gigs over London and around the country. And, it was exciting stuff. Very exciting. Anyway, you're listening to Fan Club. My name's Nick Helm. This
is... Daniel Metcalf.
This is Five Star Family Fan Size Fan Club. And we're at the earlier time. Of exactly the same time as usual for you. And
feels a bit different. I haven't had time to make myself a coffee or anything.
It does feel a bit different. We've our hand has been pushed. Is that the fact?
Yeah. Our hand's been pushed.
But you know, we're making it. The best thing about this show is that we're making the best out of a terrible situation.
Every week.
You know, and so this week is no exception. We're 13 minutes into a 2-hour window. Let's get the show started, I suppose. Sorry if I've upset anyone about my controversial views on comedy.
Get used to it.
Go back in the archive and listen to my other opinions. And you know, it won't be that. I can't talk today. I just think this is an awful listen.
But we only really get press on this show if someone else who's more famous comes on and tells a story that's already been in the press for 10 years.
Johnny Vegas tells a story that was in his autobiography, and then they print about that in the press. You know, just what have you not read his autobiography? I mean, just like print extracts. Or Jason Manfred drives a van That got in the papers.
Yes,
that was a year ago. This is almost a year ago now.
God, it is too.
So we just need to just get on with our lives. Speaking of getting on with our lives.
Yeah.
What have you been a fan of this week?
I tell you what I did watch. I also watched a couple of films. In fact, one I'll say, because we've talked about it slightly in the past. On Netflix, I noticed that Young Guns 2 was on, and I'd recently watched Young Guns, and I went, oh, yeah, I'm up for a bit of Young Guns 2. It's great. I don't know, for a film that's not... I don't feel like those films are fondly remembered. And I was really struck by how much I really, really liked it. It's just... I mean, I'm sure there's a nostalgia element, because lots of the lines in it I knew were coming. So there's an element of that to it. But it was like, for films that... I mean, I think are almost like seen as quite... I mean, I guess it's quite... a silly franchise in some ways, but I don't know. It just feels like no one talks about that film in 2021 but us. And I was really struck by, I was going, it's good. It's really good.
What's interesting about Young Guns, and because I watched Mission Impossible the other week and I'm working my way through the Mission Impossible film. So what's interesting about Young Guns is that Young Guns 1 and Young Guns 2. Young Guns 1 is a standalone movie that requires no sequel. It's got an ending.
And it's got an epilogue even, almost, to be like, and this is what happened to all the characters.
Yeah, they literally only tell half the story. It's like they're saving the other half of the story for a sequel, but the film doesn't really indicate that they're setting up a sequel.
Hmm.
It feels like it's just a standalone movie. And then they do get a sequel, and the sequel is so glossy and slick, it feels like a different beast, but... And it's kind of like, you know, is it Dermot Mulroney that's in it in Young Guns?
Mm.
And he is so grubby looking.
Yes.
Is he Stinky Pete?
I think he might be, yeah.
It's called, oh, Stinky Pete, the character in Toy Story 2. I'm not sure. So he's like this really grubby character who's sort of like, and they're all dirty, they're all cowboys. Like, the colour palette is just all almost one colour of brown.
Yes.
And the characters are all filthy, and then you've got Dermot Mulroney, who's just absolute filth. And then a couple of years later, you've got Young Guns 2, and the colours are all, like, ambers and blues. And you've got, like, I think in the first one you had Jack Palance, and in the second one, who was, like, a huge cowboy star.
Hmm.
And then the second one... you've got, and Jack Palance is in it, and it was before City Slickers. So it was before he got an Oscar for playing Curly in City Slickers and sort of like doing a pastiche on his cowboy characters. It was almost like this is the end of his career. This is his swan song, is Young Guns, where he comes in and sort of like passes the baton to a new generation.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, and I don't even think Young Guns probably did much for Jack Palance's career, except for then he was in Batman, and then the year after, it's just like, oh, no, he got an Oscar for City Slickers.
Hmm.
And then in the sequel, you've got, like, James Coburn, who's in it. And then to sort of, like, counterbalance Dermot Mulroney, you've got Christian Slater, who is sort of, like, he's, like, at his Christian Slater peak.
Yes.
Where you want a supporting character to come along and really fucking shake things up and act like he's the lead, then you put Christian Slater in your film, it's about the same time as Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And I just think that together they're these great films. And Tom Cruise has a tiny little cameo, I think, in... it's not even a cameo. He was on set one day. I can't remember what he was filming. He was filming something else. And he was, like, good mates with Emilio Estevez. And he was on set for Young Guns, I think. And at the end... he's like one of the first people to get shot during the standoff when they're in the building at the end of
right.
But I also heard that he was in the second one, so maybe he's like the first guy to get shot in the second one when the camp that they're sleeping in gets infiltrated. But anyway, it's this crossover period where Emilio Estevez was this huge star in the 80s. There's no one bigger than Emilio Estevez. And then all of a sudden, he did Loaded Weapon and Mighty Ducks. And
yes.
Then Emilio Estevez's career sort of like... I remember Mighty Ducks being a huge hit, and it had sequels. And I remember Loaded Weapon being something that I saw in the cinema. and not quite being good as Hot Shots.
Yeah.
Or Naked, and a long way off from being as good as Naked Gun. But I still really enjoyed it. And it was like, that was sort of it for Emilio Estevez.
It really was. And those films felt like, Mighty Ducks especially, and Loaded Weapon, kind of feel like they're films by someone who's kind of on a downward trajectory. And yet,
yeah,
it just feels like a year earlier, he's one of the biggest stars.
Yeah, he was huge in the... And then you've got this crossover period where Tom Cruise, who was filming something nearby, has a no line. You don't even see his face. He's sort of in a background shot of Young Guns. He'd done Top Gun. And then you get into Mission Impossible, where... Which, what year was that, 95?
96, I think.
96. So you got Mission Impossible, which is a few years after that. And Emilio Estevez pops into it. And although, yeah, you kind of like go, you know, we talked last week and you go, it's a mid-90s cast of who would be in a Mission Impossible ensemble, you know.
Hmm.
But in actual fact, it's almost too late for Emilio Estevez to be convincing as one of the main team.
Yeah, and it felt, I remember thinking it was more like a comeback, even though it didn't materialise that way. But the assumption was, oh, Emilio Estevez, cool. Yeah, cool.
I thought it was sort of like a comforting cameo.
Yes.
You know, where you go, oh, it's good that he's in it. And then when he dies, it's sort of like one of the least surprising things because you like go, well, of course, he's not going to be in the whole thing. But and so it's like this weird sort of, because Tom Cruise is so famous.
Yeah.
And he has been for 30 years. It's kind of like you just assumed that he was always famous.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, in the 80s, early 90s, I would argue that Emilio Estevez was much more famous.
Yeah. And also,
then,
I think...
But then Emilio Estevez also did Men at Work and Free Jack. And he was doing a lot of shit at the beginning of the 90s.
Yes, he was, yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's it. And maybe Young Guns 2 was like a sequel to a hit, but maybe he was already on the downward trajectory. I think now, though, you think of Emilio Estevez, when people talk about him, if they talk about him at all, it's almost a bit of a punchline, as they often talk about people who are no longer megastars. They talk about them in sort of as if they've kind of, they were never very good.
No.
I mean, when you watch it, you go, he's great. He's so charismatic in them.
I don't think that's true with Emilio Estevez. I think that there's a generation of people that maybe a couple of years younger than us that grew up with the Mighty Ducks films and
yeah.
think of him as the guy that kind of did straight to video sports comedies, yeah. sub Cool Runnings, Disney sports yeah. comedies, right? Kids based Disney films. So there's that. But I also think that because his brother is Charlie Sheen, it's kind of like and his dad is Martin Sheen. You've got like this barometer. And he went into directing and he directed Men at Work, which although is not a great film, it's kind of like a thing for him to cut his teeth on and to get started. And he, you know, he's consistently made films. And I think that's kind of like the right thing to do where he was like, right, I'm going to change careers here. It's a very brave thing to do. And for him, it was sort of, you know, it's like he didn't take his dad's name because he didn't want to cash in on it. So he's always gone like the hard route. And in a way, it's kind of like at the time when I saw Mission Impossible and Emilio Estevez pops up, you're kind of like, oh, it's Emilio Estevez. You sort of take it for granted a bit. But now, when you look back on it, especially because we've watched Young Guns and Young Guns 2, and like you say, Emilio Estevez is so good in those films. They're all good in those films that, you know, They're all brilliant. Kiefer Sutherland, Lou Diamond Phillips, they're all brilliant. Emilio Estevez is so charismatic. He's so funny. It's such an interesting take on a cowboy. He's Billy the Kid, and I think that a route that people would go is like a Clint Eastwood kind of route.
Yeah,
and he's like making jokes, and he's laughing all the time, and he's kind of like a psychopath, and it's just like this really great interpretation of that character in both of the films. And like when we rewatched the Mission Impossible the other week, it was literally like as soon as he comes on screen, it's just like, oh yeah. Whereas at the time, I think it was like, oh, him,
Yeah.
But now it's just kind of like those sort of like Emilio Estevez performance that are dotted around, you kind of like, they're like treasures, you know?
Yes, yeah.
Because he's so good. Anyway, I love him. But yeah, Young Guns 2 is really, I think it's such a weird film because it's a sequel where it tells the second half of the story, but it's just like, you must have been really fucking banking on that first film going, you know what I mean? It's like they saved so much of the story for a sequel that potentially wasn't going to happen. And then they, it's, do you know what I mean?
Yes. Especially when it plays like you say, the first one plays with like an epilogue, like, yeah, that's, and that's the end of the film. And that's what happened to all the characters, the end. It's not like to be continued. It's not got that vibe at all at the end. It's very much like that's done in one. That's the movie.
And when they did get, like the first one, it feels really gritty. It's sort of like, have you ever seen The Long Riders?
Yeah.
It's got that sort of quality, only it's much better than The Long Riders. I feel like The Long Riders is really baggy. Long Riders is a film by Walter Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a gimmicky film where Stacey Keach is in it with his brother. What's Kung Fu called?
David Carradine.
The Carradines are in it. The Quaids are in it.
Yes.
And basically they just went through and they found all of these sets of brothers and they cast them all as a big gang of brothers. And it's sort of like this, it's got like this 80s, like, so you've got like this, it's like the transitionary 70s to 80s sort of quality of a movie.
Do you know what? It really is. Now you're saying it, and I can actually, that is a lot like Young Guns or something. It has a really similar aesthetic and everything to
it. And I think Young Guns, what was that, 88? Or?
Yeah, 88, I think, yeah.
So I think it was after Breakfast Club, and you've got kind of like, it still feels like it's the 70s, 80s kind of aesthetic. And I guess they didn't really, I think the Western had pretty much died in Hollywood. And then there were like four or five big Westerns that got made in the mid 80s. And I guess Young Guns was sort of like the, and you can sort of like follow the through line where you've got Young Guns and then you've got like Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, where it's not quite because Kevin Costner isn't young like that, but then they've got like Christian Slater and stuff in it, and then Disney went like, we're making a Three Musketeers movie, and Three Musketeers feels very much like we've got half the cast of Young Guns in it and we're also doing sort of a sequel to Robin Hood.
Yeah,
you know, if this is our
we're not going to have Bryan Adams, we're going to have Bryan Adams plus Rod Stewart
and Sting. Yeah, it's kind of like Disney saw Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves and went like, we'll do like a non-official sequel to that. So there's like this through line. But like, just going back to, so Young Guns is sort of like this 70s, 80s cowboy aesthetic where they're not really making cowboy films. And Young Guns 2 comes along and it's like, it's not quite as slick as that, but it feels very kind of like Tony Scott music video kind of influenced.
Yeah.
And like, but it's so, I mean, I'm not saying this as an insult. It's so glossy and slick.
But it feels contemporary, like in a way that,
with the
contemporary to 1990 as well.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Really like contemporary modern Western.
But what I'm trying to avoid saying is that Young Guns is like an 80s movie and Young Guns 2 is like a 90s movie. I think Young Guns is like an 80s movie, an early 80s movie. Young Guns 2 is sort of like a mid 80s to early 90s movie. It's kind of like, it's not necessarily, I think when you look at, I wrote my dissertation on slasher films and you kind of like go, the 70s was all about post-Vietnam War, and then the 80s, if you follow the Friday the 13th or the Halloween series, they start off one way where they're kind of like, all right, this is post-Vietnam, this is Watergate, this is, everything is kind of like very grim and cynical. And then the 80s is all excessive and it's all just like more kills, more nudity. And then the 90s becomes very sort of like postmodern to the point where in Halloween, you've got, you've got Busta Rhymes, but they're doing like a reality TV show in it. And then in sort of like, do you know what I mean? Like, you've got one series of films that are all sequels to each other, but they adapt through the times. and just the aesthetics on. I just think there's only two. They're just these. I think I can't understand how Young Guns 1 and 2 got made. They're sort of like this enigma. They're like baffling to me because they're so different.
And 2 years apart, only 2 years apart.
They're so different, but they're perfect together. They're like a perfect set. They're not a trilogy. You only need two of them, but they're like this perfect set. And they're just very different from each other, but they tell half a story each. And then I did all of like this research after I saw Young. We talked about this when I saw Young Guns before, I'm sure.
Mm.
But like, did the research, and so much of it is factually accurate in terms of, like, you know, the best that they could do with it. You know, there's a line in it where they talk about Billy the Kid being left-handed, and Billy the Kid says, "Oh, he's not left-handed, he's right-handed, or he's ambidextrous." And that comes from the fact that there was a photo of Billy the Kid holding his gun in his left hand. And everyone just assumed that he was left-handed. But what they weren't taking into account for was that images were flipped.
Right.
And it's a reverse image. And so they're referencing... it's not just like, oh, Billy the Kid was cool. Let's just... Like in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, where they've got Billy the Kid, and there's very... It's just like, who would be a cool character from history? They haven't just sort of like gone, well, Billy the Kid is kind of like this outlaw, so let's do it. Let's adapt it all and make it kind of like relevant to 80s teens and kind of like do an 80s Brat Pack take on Young Guns. It's so historically accurate with all of the stuff that's in there that you kind of like go, oh, they've really done their homework, which made me respect the film so much more. It was, they're great.
Young Guns 2.
But you watched it.
Yeah, no, I thought it was great. And it was, like you say, very glossy. And even the fact it has like a Bon Jovi theme makes it feel like, God, it's such a big movie. It feels like you're watching a huge summer movie, and that this was perhaps what a summer movie was like in 1990. And also, like you say, Emilio Estevez's laugh is so kind of iconic at the time that it's sampled throughout that song all the time. And it's like you would know, it's Billy the Kid. It's almost like it seeped enough into the pop culture that his laugh was kind of an iconic sound in that late 80s, early 90s period, and is now forgotten to history, like the films are. They haven't sort of survived in that way. And yet you watch them and it feels like, this feels like a big movie, you know. I just thought it was weird. It just feels like you are watching something that in 1990 was probably one of the studio's big, like, summer movie. It was like, yes, a big, we're throwing a lot behind this. The first one did well, and we're gonna throw our lot in with the sequel.
I remember I was too young. My sister went to see it at the cinema and came back and was just, like, hyped and started getting Bon Jovi albums. And it was like, yeah. Oh, it's got a great soundtrack as well.
Yeah.
So, let's play speaking of the soundtracks. And speaking of being slick as fuck, let's play a game. No, a song.
Like a hammer, and I work with the
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Oh, and we're back. And it's great to be back in the... We're 36 minutes into the show, and it's flying by.
Flying by. Absolutely flying by. So what have you been a fan of this week, Nick?
I have watched a bunch of stuff. I started trying to get Letterboxd, you know, because I'd like to just have a record of everything that I've seen. Mm. But it's not saving it. Maybe you can talk me through it after we've finished.
Okay. But
it's not really saving the films that I've seen in the order that I've seen them. And I can't...
Oh, that is weird. I think it does it naturally
I'm not enjoying the format of it. Okay, so I can't really remember what I've seen this week. So I watched Mission Impossible 3 this week.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Do you know what? Funny enough, going back to Young Guns 2, I saw Mission Impossible 3 at the Odeon in Leicester Square, and sat in front of me watching it was Christian Slater.
Are you joking?
No, I was really excited. I saw him go in.
Was it the premiere? No,
it was just like a day. It was like an afternoon showing.
Oh, well, you know why?
I think it was when he was doing...
One for the Cookie
Yeah, yeah. Place. I think it was at that time. So I guess he was just living in London, and I guess his days are free, and he's gone, yeah, I'll go and see the new Mission Impossible film.
Do you know what? You are terrible at American accents and impressions, but except for Christopher Lee. But if you'd have done that impression, I would have known who that was.
Thank you. Because it's basically, he's, at the time, does that impression of Christian Slater, you think, is someone doing an impression of Jack Nicholson. That's what I always think of. So you've got to imagine someone else doing an impression of Jack Nicholson.
Christian Slater is to Jack Nicholson what the Muppet Babies are to the Muppets. what year was Mission Impossible 3?
Oh, what year is it going to be? 2000 and... I was doing comedy, so I reckon 2009?
No.
10?
No. No. Which is why now I think that it couldn't be Christian Slater, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It was 2006, can you believe it?
Wow, maybe he was filming Churchill, the
Hollywood years.
The Hollywood years.
Well, maybe he was, do you know? Maybe he was. So Mission Impossible 3... it's in a way, it's better than all of the other Mission Impossibles.
Right. So which one? Three is the one. The thing I really
remember. J.J. Abrams.
Because it was always M.I.I.I., which I liked.
Right. Yeah. But let's not talk too much about this.
No.
But what I'd say is, the first one is classic De Palma,
mm-hmm.
and then the second one is John Woo. And without the slow motion, the film, it's like 2 hours, 10 minutes. And without the slow motion, the film would honestly be about 70 minutes long. the second film is absolutely awful. But but in my heart, I can't really blame. I think John Woo, the slow motion is awful.
Yeah.
The doves are stupid. I think John Woo has aged incredibly badly in terms of what is cool.
Doug Ray Scott from being Wolverine.
Yeah, and you're watching it, and he doesn't even have a character in it, and he must have been absolutely fucking furious. It's so rubbish. It's like the presenters of Top Gear have got together, and they've made what they think is the coolest film ever made.
Right, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That's Mission Impossible 2. And it's so sort of like, whereas in the first one, there's set pieces that are really tense and they're really kind of standalone set pieces that get put together in bricks to make this, you know, really tense movie. The second one is like, there's no plot, there's no characters, I don't even know who Ethan Hunt is. And then with the third one, they've kind of like gone, we'll give him some sort of character and we'll give him some personal stakes in it. And, you know, even though they've tried to do that previously, and it's sort of like, it all works. And you kind of like go, technically, this is the best one. where it's all coming together. They've got like Philip Seymour Hoffman in it. He's great. And it's all sort of like coming together. But it's in my heart, nothing is as good as the first one so far.
Right.
So it's kind of like you've got maybe the first one is like a 4-star movie. Then you've got like a 1 or 2-star movie. And then you've got like a solid 3 where you go, there's elements of Tom Cruise's character is the most clear in this film. His hair is the optimum length. You've got a really decent bad guy, but the set pieces aren't tense.
Is that Michelle Monaghan? Is that that one?
Yeah, she's brilliant.
She's great. I love her.
She's brilliant. And yeah, there's some really good stuff in it. Anyway, so that's that. And I also watched Raising Kane. And anyone that's seen Raising Kane, put your hands up. Raising Hands, more like. And what I would say is that there's 2 edits of Raising Kane, isn't there? There's the... Yeah. Official theatrical release of Raising Kane, which was Brian De Palma in 1990.
Yeah.
And then some guy did a fan edit of it, which was he found the original script. And even though there weren't any deleted scenes, he reorganized the existing
film, yeah.
Footage. He chopped up the film and he put it in the order that it was presented in the script as best he could. And put it online, and Brian De Palma saw it, and he said, right, that's great. And he wrote personally to the DVD company, and he said, and he phoned them up, I think, and he just said, oh, this is Brian De Palma. And they were like, fuck, there's this online thing, and it's really good, and it's basically the film that I wanted to make. So that should be an official extra on the DVD. And then I think they put a bit of money into it and cleaned it up and made it like all super slick. And basically... I can't, even though I've seen the theatrical cut of Raising Kane, for the life of me, I cannot work out why it's edited that way. It's absolutely insane.
It feels like normally these films would be the other way round. Like the studio would go, no, you're trying to be a bit too arty here. You're trying to do things. It's like they've gone in and made it much more confusing. Whereas when you watch the fan edit version of it, it's just more like, yeah, got it.
Absolutely. Like, so, and I, even when I was watching the original, I was like going, well, it must start with this scene, surely.
Mm.
The film is about John Lithgow. There's spoilers, but I mean, it's more about, like, I had to do a thing the other day and I have this, and I had this, I wrote this jingle and it's for TV. Like, I'm doing a bit in a panel show where I come on and I do a game that I've invented, right? Like a quiz show, right? And I've written a jingle, and in my script that I've written, the jingle gets played like 20 times, right? And the producers are like going, yeah, but can we just, I mean, the jingle is 40 seconds long. So every time you play the jingle, that means that, you know, it eats up 40 seconds. And I had to say to the producer,
that's the joke.
you're looking at the jingle as something that's getting in the way of content. Yeah. When in actual fact, the jingle is content.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, you can't shortcut that. It has to be like whatever it, you know, that exactly what you say. It's the joke, but it's kind of like you're looking at that like, well, once we get through the jingle, then we can do the thing. It's just like, or we can cut the jingle in the edit. And you go, no. That is what I've written the jingle. I'm going to stand on stage next to the jingle while the jingle is playing. That is my content. That is what I'm going to do. And Brian De Palma was like saying, oh, it's all trickery and it's all like camera tricks and it's all kind of like you can see his process and you go, yeah, that is the content. That is my film, is you watching all of these camera tricks and things like that. But when you watch it, for the life of me, I cannot fucking work out, you know, it's a film about a guy with multiple personality disorder and he's a murderer. Mm-hmm. And that is the twist that comes halfway through the film in the script. But in the movie, in the theatrical cut, they put the reveal of John Lithgow being a murderer in the first scene. So it opens with him either murdering someone or knocking someone out.
Yeah.
And all the way through it, you know he's a bad guy. Whereas, go on.
Well, I was going to say also, throughout the film, you've got scenes in it which are dream sequences and things, which when you watch the fan edit, you go, right, that's a dream. But when you're watching it all interspersed with different parts of it, you start going, so when's that happened? When's this happened? Yeah. It becomes like it's using dream logic at a point where you're supposed to... You've got no solid thing to put a dream on. You know what I mean? Yeah. You've got no solid timeline to put where the dream is happening.
And but it's also treating the dream like it's really happening.
Yeah.
Because that's all the footage they've got. So when Brian De Palma, he panicked when he was putting the edit together. He did some test screenings that didn't work. And so he put everything in a chronological order. So wherever it happened in time is where it comes in the film. And it's kind of like... No, you're meant to be, it's meant to be like a bait and switch. It's meant to be kind of like Psycho, because it's all Hitchcock, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's meant to be, you know, it's meant to be like Psycho, where you're following his wife as the main character for 40 minutes. And then halfway through, John Lithgow is the main character. Whereas in the theatrical edit, John Lithgow is always the main character. And when you're watching it, you're going, why? I haven't seen the fan edit yet. I'll watch that for next week. But you're watching it and you're going, why on earth do it this way? It's mental. Speaking of why on earth do it this way, The Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, we'll do one of our famous one-word reviews.
Okay. What's my word?
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Properly.
Absolutely amazing.
One word.
I took the space out.
Did you have a hyphen in the middle?
No.
Wow.
It's just all one word.
Right.
I loved it.
It's like a course correction film. And I was struck by it after. I really liked it too. I thought it was great. And I was struck at the end how it shouldn't work either, because all it's doing is constantly doing course correction. And it's like, it's almost like, it's like it's doing... It's like making up for the last film and going, this is what you're supposed to do. Doesn't feel like there's enough to do your own film, and yet it's really satisfying.
It makes up for the last film in the first 10 minutes.
Right, yeah.
And then it's got 2 hours to just enjoy it. And the jokes are brilliant. Like, it's a funnier film than most comedies. Right. And I find it, as a comedian, I find it really interesting the way humor is used in non-comedic films, or not necessarily non-comedic films. Like, comedy is a shade that you can use as part of your palette as a filmmaker, as a storyteller. You can use humor. But this is sort of like a superhero movie, but it's basically it's a $200 million comedy. It's fucking great. The cast is brilliant. Idris Elba is just phenomenal in it.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen him better.
I thought he was perfect. And, like, I'm not a fan. I've spent a year and a half watching all the fucking Sky adverts of him selling Sky Cinema. And he's just on every ad break when I'm just trying to work out who's going to win the chase, right? And he just pops up in every advert break. And so to go to the cinema, to actually pay £20 or whatever it was to go and see him at the cinema, I was like, I get him for free every fucking 5 minutes. He was so good in it. I absolutely loved it. And what I fucking loved the most, no, not the, I just loved the whole thing. It was so dark. It was so gory and sort of mean-spirited. I also thought it said some really sort of like profound things about relationships. I thought that Harley Quinn monologue was, yeah, it was in character, but it was also really beautiful, and it was just really, and also, you know, looking at all of these franchises that have had kind of like all sorts of gender politics put into identity politics thrown into all of these films lately, where it's very kind of like front and center. I thought this film was just it was diverse and accessible without remotely being heavy-handed. I thought that the cast was incredible, And the thing that what I loved about it was the fact that there are some returning characters from the original Suicide Squad. And I just really just did. It's one of the only films I've ever walked out of. It was the first Suicide Squad. And there's returning characters in this, and you really care about them straight away. It's like when Captain Boomerang comes back, you're like, I like him. They just handled him great. I think Captain Boomerang is one of the only things that actually it works like 75% in the original. And so Captain Boomerang in this, Jai Courtney, it's just like, you know, Jai Courtney's in a superhero film, no thanks. And then all of a sudden you go like, oh, he's brilliant in it. And Jai Courtney's great. And then it makes you all of a sudden go, oh, maybe I've kind of like given him like a bit of a hard time. You know, he's used for evil a lot of the time, like inappropriately as like Terminator Genesis as a Michael Biehn replacement. You go, he didn't look anything like him. What's the point? What's the point in trying to get everyone to, it doesn't matter. I thought it made you really care. I thought Rick Flagg was like, crazily, he's one of the least charismatic, interesting characters in the first film. It's kind of, who gives a fuck about Rick Flagg in the first film? In the second one, he has like three laugh out loud moments. And his character's brilliant. He sort of like keeps the team together. And you end up really caring about Rick Flagg. And it's just like, that's insane, right?
Yeah, and it is, because you can barely... I know that character, because I know that's a character who's from the comics, and he's one of the big characters in the comics. And I know he's in the first Suicide Squad movie. But when you watch it, you go, oh, yeah, yeah, he was in it too, wasn't he? That's how you feel.
Yeah.
Like, it's like you've forgotten he was even in the film.
Well, when I saw...
he was in it as well, wasn't he?
When I saw the trailer for The Suicide Squad, this new one, and he's in it, you go, you've brought him back. He would be one of the easiest people to just ignore. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the fact that they've actually not just brought him back and then got rid of him in the first 2 minutes, the fact that, no spoilers, but like, the fact that they've brought him back and he's got so many sort of like, because he's not a superhero either, right? And so they've brought him back and he's got so many standout moments in the cast that big. Everyone gets a moment to shine, basically. It's really well put together. I just think it's so funny. It's dark, it's sick, but it's also got a really like warm heart to it.
Yeah. I feel actually now we start talking about it, I've realised there's lots I could say about it. So I might talk more about it next week because there's a lot about it that it was a real experience watching it as well. Like what I was thinking almost minute to minute of like, well, what's this going to be like? And then things happening, and I was going, that's a really good idea. And I felt like it kept, there were times, but mainly usually at the start where I was a little bit kind of on the fence about it. And then something had happened and it would earn another 10 minutes. And it did that all the way to the end. Like I kept going, I'm a bit, maybe. And then something had happened. I'd go, love that. And then there would be, and then the next time I was like wavering a bit going, something else had happened. I'd go, love that. Love that bit.
I know what you mean. I do know, and I know what you mean, but I think I'm a bit more passive in terms of as an audience member. And I went into this having seen like a lot of, I hadn't read any reviews, hadn't watched any reviews, but I went into it knowing that there was a bit of a positive buzz about it. Yeah. And I was thinking, this is going to be great. And it was. And that rare, hey, for a start, that rarely happens. Going into a film, expecting it to be good and it being good, right? Sometimes you're surprised because you think it's going to be shit and it's not. And sometimes you go in and it's like, it's disappointing. And this just fulfilled all my expectations and exceeded them in a way. And I'm not a massive fan of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies.
No, I'm not, which I think is, I'm similar, that I kind of, and there's bits of it where I kind of go, this is a bit too much Guardians of the Galaxy. And that's what I was expecting. And that was a bit of it I was slightly dreading. And it wasn't what I was expecting at all.
This felt like he'd had to... This felt like the trauma guy. This felt like the guy that directed Super that was doing, like, a mainstream movie.
Yeah.
Without, like, losing a lot of his edge. I thought that's what was that's what was really good about it. But also, almost the same experience as you, but it's sort of like I'd go, wow, that's incredible. And then I would find myself sort of like maybe drifting off a little bit and kind of like it would not lose me, but I would kind of like maybe I had something on my mind and then all of a sudden it would suck me right back in again. And a bit of, so it's like you where you're kind of like actively going, I'm not sure if I'm enjoying this right now. Now I am. It would be me kind of like without realizing I wasn't giving it my 100%. And then all of a sudden I'd go, oh, right. Wow. Fucking. And I think like that, you're right. Every 10 minutes, there's something that sort of like drags you back in, but it never sort of like, I just found myself like kind of like feeling that there were like little sags in between the bits. But I mean, it was so smart and funny, and it was just, you didn't want to laugh at some of the stuff, and some of the stuff just had me like laughing for a minute in the cinema. And I loved going to the cinema as well. Yeah, it was brilliant. And the other thing that I did was I went back and I watched the original Comic-Con footage from the original Suicide Squad movie.
Okay.
To try and get an idea of what the film that David Ayer was trying to deliver. And when you watch that original video without any of the day glow and the Bohemian Rhapsody and all that stuff, hasn't got any of that stuff in it. It's kind of like this... You can see that it's a very dour, gritty film. And I think even if it was David Ayer, it wouldn't be like a fun watch.
Yeah.
And I think that no matter what they tried to do was they tried to edit a very serious, gritty movie and make it into a fun movie by doing patch jobs and reshoots and using the soundtrack. When in actual fact, this feels like it's the film that they kind of wanted originally.
Yes, exactly. And also just like, it's what they should have done originally as well. It's like, this is exactly what you should have done.
This is exactly what you should have done originally. And it's weird that they didn't. And what I would say is I'm a big fan of the movie The Joker. Or is it just called Joker?
I'm not sure. I think it's Joker, isn't it? Just Joker.
So I'm a big fan of Joker, and I'm a big fan of Wonder Woman, and I'm a big fan of Zack Snyder's Justice League. And I would say, in terms of just going in and enjoying a film, this was just the best DC movie that they've made. It's up there with Joker, but it's an entirely different experience, and they're not within the same universe. It's so much fun. I loved it. And it's flopping, so if you think you might be interested, you should go and see it, because this
is
film,
it really I yeah, think it's doing well. Really well.
No, it made 23 million in its opening weekend.
Okay,
which is right. Shit. And and I think that this film definitely deserves a sequel. The first film, when they announced this, it's just like, what the fuck are you doing making another Suicide Squad? Now you see it, you go, mate, loads of these. These are brilliant. Okay, we'll just do one quick bit of fan mail, and then we'll get Steve on. Is it he's in the waiting room? I'm sure fan mail soon. Yes, absolutely. Don't worry, Irene. God, you're on it. You're really on it. Family. Afternoon, Nick, Nathaniel, George Metcalf. Bollocks. And you know, there's a different voice for it. Natalie, Brian, Christopher, and perhaps even Patrick and Paul, if they're about. And Irene. As always, I'm loving the show, to be honest, even.
To be honest, even more so than normal at the moment. I think the female guests you've had on recently seem to really get the fan club spirit. Maybe time to move up to a 6-star status.
Yeah, not like those pesky male guests that we have that don't get the concept at all. No names mentioned. I went to see the new Benedictine comes in batches film, The Courier, last night. It was perfect. Still a really good old school slow burner of a spy film. Definitely recommend it if you enjoy the worst of Jean Le Carré. I also rewatched the Tim Burton Batman films and totally agree with Nathaniel.
George Metcalf's
opinion. I can take or leave Batman, but love Batman Returns. I think we both said that. However, I couldn't help thinking that if I was picking someone from Beetlejuice to play Bruce Wayne Batman, I'd have gone with Alec Baldwin.
I think we said that too.
Fair point. I've also been thinking that Stephen Graham, I thought you were going to say Stephen Baldwin, would be perfect to play Wolverine. What do you think? Yes.
Yeah, that. Yeah.
I mean, he's in many ways he's like a contemporary Bob Hoskins. And do either of you have any other dream castings for iconic roles? Anyway, All the best to you and yours, and love once more from Tom in Tampere, Finland. Hello, Tom. That's lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you know what? It's not a dream casting, but I thought, what's the wrestler who plays Peacemaker in Suicide Squad?
Oh, John Cena.
I thought he would be a perfect Superman.
Yeah, he's another one who's great, isn't he? Anyway, we can't keep talking about this.
But he would be a perfect Superman. He's sort of like non-complicated. I think the problem that they do with Superman is they make him too complicated. Just make him non-complicated. He's a guy that turns up. John Cena, he'd be great. Right, let's play a song and get our guest on.
Yes.
He's not in the room yet, actually.
He is.
Oh, he's joined now. This is a real fucking roller coaster for us and you.
Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
We're back. We're back live. We're not live, we're pre-recorded. And we're in the studio. We're not in the studio. I'm in my office, I suppose. And Nat is in what we tentatively call his washroom. And we're joined now in the... we're in the clubhouse. That's what we are. We can be anywhere we want. We're in the Fan Club Treehouse Clubhouse. And we're joined now by actor, writer... stand-up comedian and now sitcom creator or co-writer.
Let's say creator.
Sitcom creator, Steve Bajaya. Hello, how are you doing?
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me. I'm very good, thank you.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for being on. So you are currently, not you are, but you are. You're currently in the sitcom Buffering that's over on ITV 2.
Yeah.
That's on at the moment. Is that right?
I gave myself a role. Yeah. I think if you create a sitcom, it'd be silly not to put yourself in it, wouldn't it?
It would. Oh, is that on purpose? I couldn't tell. When you first showed up, I thought, oh, it's like a cameo. But then I went, oh, no, he's in every episode.
It very much so. And the role gets bigger.
It does.
The commissioners were quite clear in the first script that they weren't keen on the character and they wanted to be a small one. But the thing about that is they don't notice it get bigger slowly through the rest of the series. And by the episode 6, they were like, oh, we like that thing guy. I'm like, yeah, well, there you go. And also I found out that I got paid per episode. So I was quite keen to make sure I did appear at least one line in each episode just to get that fee.
That is good. Do you get paid per episode or per shooting day?
No, per episode. So that's what I found out. So I was like, well, as long as... I mean, you get a bonus for the shooting day, but it's negligible compared to the... So really what mattered was making sure I had one line in the episode.
That's really good.
I mean, smart. The producer tried to cut that first line in the episode 1 because actually it's one of the least important lines in the whole thing.
We were
pretty tight for time. We're pretty tight for time. And to be honest, some pretty important stuff had to get cut. But I was not willing to budge. I was absolutely not willing to budge.
Of course not. And I know from a writer's point of view that you do have a lot of sway with the execs. So that is that's very good. It's very good that you managed to do that. I think that your character is intrinsic in that first episode.
I appreciate that, Nick. I think it has to be, because otherwise it wouldn't
make sense later that you become... Because otherwise you just show up. You need to have something that makes you memorable to be...
Exactly.
It's that guy.
Yeah, it's the guy. It's the sort of dweeby little nervous guy. And now he's even more nervous and he's in it more.
It is amazing that we've talked about buffering for almost 5 minutes and not mentioned Ian Sterling yet.
That is how I like to do it. I like to almost ignore the fact that he's the star of the show and exclusively talk about my character, Finn.
Well, yeah. Exactly. You'll be with the part up so much that next series you'll probably be the star of it and no one will have noticed.
Hey, if we get another series, you will not believe how small Ian's role is going to be.
When you're a part in a thing, you are meant to see your character from the point of view of, well, I might not be the lead, but I still have a life outside of my scenes. So, and we had on one thing I did, there was an actor that came along and he would come in and he'd go, I like to think about what my character's up to. And it's kind of like, you're in one scene in this series.
And he was like planning out his character's day.
Yeah, and it's just kind of like, just say the lines and let's have lunch.
He's been for coffee with his mum. He's a little bit off.
It was like, yeah, all right. But no, it's good that you can see the entire thing through the eyes of your character. That's brilliant.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I should mention Ian Sterling is the star of it and the main draw, some would say.
Well, but it is an ensemble, right? It doesn't... I thought it'd be more an Ian Sterling show, but it does feel like the more you go on, it doesn't feel like it's Ian Sterling and friends. No, it's kind of...
Yeah, it is intentionally an ensemble. And to be fair, that was Ian who was keen for that as well. And yeah, because we've got such a brilliant cast. Like, the cast are great. Like, Jesse Cave, Rosa Robson, Paul G. Raymond, Elena Sorrell, and Janine Haruni. They're just all so funny. It seems silly just to have them playing second fiddle. We were pleased that we did that. Because I think by the fifth episode, Ian's like not even in the C story. I mean, he's in it, but he's not in the main two stories. And I think that's one thing we're really proud of, actually.
That's good. I think with sitcoms as well, the ones that have like the most longevity are the ones that I don't know what I'm talking about. Well, like The Office was an ensemble, but I'm also thinking about stuff like Friends, which I guess this has stuff in common with, because it's kind of like Friends for this generation.
We were very keen not to make that comparison in any pre... Because Ian once on a podcast said, oh, yeah, sort of like the next generation's Friends. And I was like, no, do not say that. That is, you cannot make that comparison.
But the thing is, I've made that comparison and I'm just an observer. So
that's fine.
Might not like saying it out loud, but we're all thinking it.
Well, that's nice. But I think it ultimately isn't. There's a lot of things that make it not the same, mainly budget.
There is a flat share element where you've got six people, but it's called buffering, and it's about kind of like that phase in your life where which is late, which is like mid-30s to like, I mean,
yeah,
I'm 40 now and I bought my first place what, 2 years ago. Like I was renting up until then. I wasn't doing like flat share stuff, but like it's the reality for most people that right up into almost your early 40s, and there's no one's like saying it's right or wrong, but it's kind of like you end up having to kind of like put your life on hold as you try and get basics in place. You know?
I know, and it's a nightmare. I don't know if it's a London thing or it's just our generation, but I definitely feel bang smack in the middle of it. Ian, annoyingly, is so successful that he is very much circumvented the buffering stage and has bought a house and is married with a child. So he is...
That's why he needs you. He needs you because he's lost such...
He's lost touch. He's lost touch with this struggle.
He's lost all touch with reality that he's just like, I've got an idea. I've got a sitcom, but I need someone to co-create it with me.
Yeah.
Now, I first became aware of Ian because I was in a children's show called Big Babies back in 2008 or 2009. And he used to present, he was in the broom cupboard. And so he used to present it. My mum used to watch Big Babies. I think we did 10 episodes. And she used to do an impression of him.
Your mum?
Yeah. She used to go, oh, it's time for Big Babies. And she didn't know. He had a character, he had a dog called Hacker.
Yeah.
And so my first introduction to Ian Sterling was the fact that I was in a kids show that he presented, that he introduced on TV. And then he's now, you know, some 12 years later, written a sitcom about being a children's presenter with a puppet sidekick.
And it's the same guy. The puppeteer who's controlling Larry the Lizard in Buffering is the same guy who controlled Hacker.
Oh, really?
Which was a nice little... That's a nice little reunion for those two. And also, there's so many kids who grew up watching probably Big Babies and Ian. No,
kids didn't watch Big Babies. Drug addicts watched Big Babies.
Oh, well, it's still a market.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
And they still come and see you today, don't they, Nick? They say absolutely. That they
absolutely. What was the premise of Big Babies, Nick? Just so
we can it was baby bodies that were filmed. Oh, like babies with adult heads stuck over them.
Like superimposed, wasn't it? Superimposed. It was Spencer Jones, wasn't it?
It was Spencer Jones and John Reese, who's a director that I've worked with quite a bit. And it was like a special effects extravaganza, and I was a glove puppet called May. I don't think I was a glove puppet. I was a cuddly toy, but it was operated by a puppeteer. And because you said he's the one that controls, did you say controls Hacker?
Yeah.
I think he's what would you say? He operates Hacker.
Well, he is Hacker.
Isn't a way that you say it is a little bit kind of fictionalized, where you say he brings Hacker to life.
Yes. Yeah, I guess controls makes it sound like Hacker's a slight victim of the...
like he's in some sort of abusive relationship.
Yeah. He doesn't let Hacker leave the house. He doesn't let Hacker have a bank account.
Poor old Hacker. Anyway, yeah.
Do you know what? I didn't notice till that episode where he gets banged on the head that you go, oh, yeah, you never see him. I think that's kind of a nice thing. But it hadn't even occurred to me that I'd never seen the guy who's operating it.
Yeah, until the very end.
Until you make a point of saying, oh, yeah, we haven't seen him.
And we sort of wrote that, and we were like, oh, we never really asked the puppeteer if he minded actually being in it himself. And then just on the day of filming, we were like, oh, do you mind actually? We just realised in this scene, you're in it. Do you mind? And he was like, yeah, I've worn my best shirt. And he was like wearing a really flowery, beautiful shirt. So I think he's excited to have his moment in the limelight. You know, he spent so long with his hand up a glove.
Oh, well, good for him.
Yeah.
But it's like he's made so many dreams come true through his career. That it's nice that you finally managed to make his dreams come true.
Well, I don't know. Let's not ask him.
Just take the credit.
I once did. Have you ever done that kids show, Dog Ate My Homework? You know, that panel show on CBBC?
No.
No, after Big Babies, don't let me do kids TV.
Well, basically, I did that once, and Hacker was the guest, was the other panelist. So it was me, a child team captain, me, and then a puppet on the team. Which is it's difficult. I think that's harder than model.
What was Hacker? Was Hacker a dog?
Hacker was a dog. Is a dog. Still exists. And there was a moment. There's a live studio audience, all kids and their parents. And there was a moment in between takes where he just got up. The puppeteer just got up with Hacker on his hand and just walked around the set. And I just saw about 400 kids just their dreams die right in front of them. And he he just couldn't be on the floor for that long.
No. So, I mean, I'm sure his knees are killing him, but it does feel like a cruel moment. Can they not call an emergency? Or yeah, he should have like a curtain or something.
Yeah.
When he brings a curtain out and a man leaves and you just have to go, ah, it's just some blood.
Yeah, Hacker's gone to the toilet now. Oh, this guy's here as well.
Well, he's wearing one of those all-black morph suits. And then he gets up and then he just sort of like walks off to the bog with his hands by his side and Hacker's just sort of like hanging there lifeless and dead, but like he's floating through the air.
I guess what's worse? Is it worse that the kids think Hacker's died or that he has been operated by 45-year-old man?
I think probably died, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
because you know, I got really sad when loads of money got killed on Comet Relief. So, if you can all remember back that far, guys, loads of money was to Harry Enfield. Oh my god, fucking hell!
How old do you think the characters in your head are? The characters in the show?
They are supposed to be late 20s, early 30s, so like 29. Yeah, 29. Day.
But that's about right, isn't it?
It's about right. Yeah, they all sort of are. Ian, what's Ian?
33.
Yeah. I think they all roughly are that age. So
I was absolutely fucking shocked that he was 33.
What, you thought he was older?
Yeah.
Well, I couldn't fucking believe it.
I couldn't fucking believe. Well, like I said, he's been presenting stuff for 12, you know, I was aware of him 12 years ago, which means he was, what, 21 when he was doing that?
Yeah, he's straight out of uni. I think they spotted him at uni and he just literally, his first job out of uni was in a broom cupboard.
Disgusting.
Yeah, I mean, he's lived a charmed existence. He walked straight out of Kids TV into Love Island. Like, he's had a nice life.
No wonder he can't relate to the real world. congratulations, well done with all that. How did it come about? How did you get the job?
It came about because I've been writing sitcoms for ages, like just which no one read, obviously. And then Ian got approached by a company who were just like, do you want to try and make something? He said, Steve knows how to do that. So then he got me involved. And then we did it very slowly. And you know how long these things take. For about 3 years, we developed it. And then eventually someone said, yeah. And I remember the moment I got the commission. I was in Edinburgh. It was the second day of Edinburgh. And I was feeling pretty low already.
What year in Edinburgh?
It was the most recent Edinburgh. 2019.
19, yeah.
I was about to get a haircut, right? And I sat waiting for my haircut and Ian rings me and goes, mate, we've got the commission. They've commissioned 6 episodes. It's going to go out next summer. And then I put the phone down. My life had just changed. I couldn't believe the news. And then the hairdresser comes over and goes, right, do you want to come have your haircut now? And I just had to sit in a chair for half an hour and not talk to anybody about this life-changing moment. And I just wanted to run around and like ring my mum or my girlfriend or whatever. But I just had to, the only person I could tell was this bloody hairdresser. And all she said was, I don't really like comedy. And I was like, great. Well, that's the end of that conversation.
Were you also furious that you had to do another 24 dates at Edinburgh?
Oh, absolutely. And I got a bad review. I got a bad review that day. It was a guy actually who, since he got fired mid-festival because he was writing such bad reviews.
But like negative reviews or they were shit?
Just bad, yeah, badly written. Also negative, but like badly written and didn't really know what he was talking about.
Fucking hell, sure it wasn't. No, I don't want to get involved in a turf war.
No, it definitely is that, Nick. It definitely was him. He was writing bad reviews. That's
sure,
not good.
Sure it wasn't.
No.
Sure it wasn't the head honcho himself. No. Not going to get
Anyway, the point is, I got a bad review, and that day I was feeling very down. I remember my manager came in to see the show that night, and she was like, oh, congrats on the sitcom. And I was like, nah, don't give a shit. Got a bad review out. I've only sold 25 tickets. This is bullshit. And she's like, no, it doesn't matter. You don't need Edinburgh anymore. And
then you can't leave. If you're yeah, said, all right, see you later, I'll get in a train.
But that's what Edinburgh does to you, doesn't it? Edinburgh just makes you think that all that matters is that show and that.
Oh, it's a bubble.
Love Edinburgh. That's what I love it.
It's because you smash it, Nick. You smash it every single time. Yeah. No wonder you bloody love it.
Every single time as well. I'm not going to, I mean, it would be awful if I said it, but it's great to finally get a guest on that's heard of me.
I remember watching you do the Pleasance Fourth Which show that was.
Clean Up Stand to the Ground. No, Pleasant Force was One Man Megamyth.
Yeah, that was it. The one where you screen skip it at the at your tech.
Yeah.
Very funny. I often think about that when a bad song comes on. I just think skip it.
That's my favorite thing I've ever done.
What that show?
That routine, that skip it bit.
Is it? That's my favorite bit.
I think it's brilliant.
And then what was the song that you ended on? Because obviously the joke was that it was loads of shit songs, and then you set up a ridiculous song.
The joke was that they were all gay anthems, saying skip it because the audience are meant to think that I don't, that my iPod is filled with gay anthems, and my image is all about like heavy rock and heavy metal. And so I'm like going, skip it. And there's Pet Shop Boys and Kylie Minogue. And I'm going, skip it. And then...
is it Xanadu?
It lands on Xanadu. And I go, thank you. And it's just that I wanted to listen to Xanadu, which is a fucking banger. I've got a framed poster of the album artwork of Xanadu in my bedroom. I love... Yeah, anyway. So I don't know. I think it's a fairly near the knuckle joke these days.
Very funny.
A lot of people wouldn't wait for the punchline to make their decision about what sort of person I am. So I don't know.
I think it's fine.
I don't think also, were you wearing spandex at the time? You're definitely wearing something that made it.
Yeah, I was wearing spandex. Yeah, but, you know, it's all good. I mean, every single, just for the record, every single one of those songs on there is on my personal iPod. And I still have an iPod Nano.
Nano?
I don't have an iPod. I don't think I did at the time. Let's not talk about my career. we've had an hour of that. So let's talk more about your terrible review.
Oh, yeah. Let's get into that. It was, you know, it was hurtful about it. It was a whole show about my mum. It was a whole show about growing up with a single mum. And I think it was a good show. It got nice reviews other than that one. But the guy said it was boring. I was like, well, that's just a nasty to my mum, isn't it? She said her life was dull.
So how many stars did you get?
It doesn't matter how many stars. The point is,
it was one.
It was less than three, and it was more than one.
Oh, two is the worst, isn't it?
It's hurtful. It's really hurtful.
Two is like, it's just like you can't do anything with a two because they're not saying it's shit. They're just saying it's unremarkable. And so if you've got a one-star review, you have all these fucking jackals that turn up to watch a one-star show.
Yeah.
You're brilliant. I've sold out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but and two is like but just two, pointless.
Two and three is like, what are you meant to do with that?
Yeah, it's a shame.
It's only their opinion. And who's laughing now?
And, you know, I maintain there was a tech issue that show. That was what threw me off. That's what made it dull. It wasn't the writing.
Yeah. I had a tech issue for an entire month once. it's terrible. Nah, you just fix it on day three, don't you? But it's too late by then. Would you do Edinburgh again?
Yeah, and I would. I do actually love it. And I've sort of missed it. I thought about going up this year, actually, but then I just thought, no, why? But I will go up next year, I think. And
how's it working this year? I don't really, because everyone's, not everyone. I keep getting people saying, "Are you doing Edinburgh?" And I'm like, I'm not doing Edinburgh, but I didn't even realise until it was way too late that it was even an option.
Yeah, so it's weird.
I might have done.
People are doing like I think two or three dates, basically, in like very few venues that are open. But it does seem like people are going. Like just from pictures of people putting up, like, it seems like people are selling out or whatever. So, but yeah, it's not a proper fringe. But yeah, I would go back. Yeah, because I mean, there's no better feeling, is it? Like than writing a show and doing it for a month. It is amazing. Even you know, even on the down days, the feeling.
I like writing it. I like having done Edinburgh. It's the bit in the middle that's the tough bit. I think at the end of it, I've really pleased myself.
But there are some happy days at Edinburgh, sure. Like there's, when you get a good crowd and you smash it, there's no better feeling.
It's a bit like joining a gym, right? And you think, I'm going to join a gym. And so you join the gym, but then you've actually got to go to the gym. And then you kind of like drag your feet and then you do it and then you go to, but once you've gone to the gym, at the end of going to the gym, you feel great. But actually the process of going to the gym.
Yeah. And also you have to go to lots of little gyms before you go to the main gym to test whether you're good enough to go to the main gym.
Well, yeah, you basically go, well, I want to go to the gym, but it's in my building and a lot of my neighbours go to that gym. So I've got to go to little gyms to actually get some definition and tone so that when I turn up to the gym, I'm not like starting from scratch.
Yeah.
Also, I question how useful the little gyms are sometimes because they often have bear no relation to the big gym at all. And so you're just practicing saying something.
Agreed.
Which has no real relation to what you're doing. And all it really does is it just means whatever the last one is, it will decide what your mood is for your first show of the
Gym. If you have a good preview, the last one before Edinburgh, you're in for a tough month. You need to dine your ass hard about July, you know, whatever it is, 28th. And then go in with just no confidence. So then you work hard right at the end.
Yeah, I think that I was looking through Facebook is such a weird app. Like, I don't ever go on Facebook, but I get kind of notifications and you go on it and I literally cannot kind of like navigate my way around Facebook on my phone anymore. And yet it comes up with like reminders of like, this is what you're doing 7 years ago. This is what you're doing 12 years ago. And you go, yeah, all right. They all left me. Stop reminding me.
That baby show come up again.
And big babies. And so it's like, I got like these updates, these status updates of Facebook. And it was like going, you know, like 11 years ago, I was ill in bed. throwing up and with a fever like 3 days before I was getting on a train and going up to Edinburgh. It said, you know, this is the week before Edinburgh and I'm bedridden. And I think that happened like two times. There was one time in 2010 where I had a bunch of previews and I just like cancelled all the previews. I was like, I'm not going to do them. And that was one of the best years I've ever had, where you just like go, I had a choice of either I lose my voice and go and do all the previews, or I just rest my voice for a week because the previews are shit and I'll just see what it's like up in Edinburgh. I think the less I like writing a show for Edinburgh and then getting off the train and doing
just seeing how it goes.
Yeah,
I definitely over previewed with others. Well, I pretty all my shows I did like 30 previews and it was just insane. Like, there were some really good ones, but you just drive yourself into the ground, like traveling around to fucking Darlington to perform to 10 people, and then you take what they thought was gospel and you rewrite the whole thing. Like, it's just mad.
Yeah, and I also think that the general public sort of misunderstand what a preview is, and they say comedy for a fiver, brilliant, and then they go and then they're like, well, this is shit, and you go, well, yeah.
that's why it's a fiver.
But so I sort of like, whenever I preview, I try and stay within London, and then after Edinburgh, that's when you take it out and about. Because sometimes I did a preview in Leeds and then I did Edinburgh and then I went to Leeds and I did it, and people were like, we've already seen the show. And you go, well, you didn't. You saw maybe three jokes in this show, but you saw it as a preview. You've got to understand the difference between me reading off a piece of paper and me, you know, in spandex, like doing a finished show. You got to.
That's Leeds for you, isn't it?
Leeds is the best place to gig.
Is it? Do you think?
The Wardrobe in Leeds is my favourite.
Oh, yeah, that is a good theatre. I think Manchester's my favourite. I can't think where specifically.
I think the dance. Is it the dance school?
Yeah, dance house.
The dance house in Manchester is incredible. Actually, it's weird. I find London gigs tough. I think Brighton is the toughest. And then as soon as you start going north, they're all amazing. And then like Leeds and Manchester are real standouts. And then Glasgow.
Yes. Yeah, Glasgow's incredible.
And for some reason, Brighton is just kind of like, we're not... Like, I'll go into Manchester, I'll go, oh, fucking hell, Manchester. And then they'll be like, whoa. But you go into Brighton and you go, fucking hell, Brighton. And they're like, well, if you don't like it in Brighton, no one's making you come here.
I used to think that Liverpool was by far the hardest place to gig until Hot Water Comedy Club came along. And now it's literally the easiest gig in the world. So they've really had a change of fortunes for Liverpool.
So what's that? What's Hot Water Comedy? Come on, explain to...
Oh, it's...
Explain to the listeners.
A relatively new club that they set up, these lads, and they used to just run a gig in a travel lodge. And they've saved up and bought a venue, and it's genuinely the best comedy club in the country. And they just know how to run a comedy night, and it packs out every single... Like, they do like five shows on a Friday. It's insane. It's just a joy to play. And they've sort of made famous... They've sort of made celebrities out of some of their main compares and stuff. Like, Paul Smith has basically launched a career off being the compere of this comedy club because everyone in Liverpool goes there and watches all the clips online. It's just incredible. It's like a little cult.
Oh, they're the Clip Boys.
They're the Clip Boys. They're the ones who pioneered the clip. Now every club has a bloody camera and puts emails you after and said, can we put this online? I'm like, no, don't put it online. Yeah. It's always, all my jokes.
They've got five gigs a night. And do you five of them if you get booked for it?
There's two venues and you double, and there's like three in one venue and then two in the other. And then you do it for Saturday as well.
Do you do all five gigs or do you just do...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, you run between them.
Must be fucking knackered, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty knackering, yeah. But incredible.
Good. But then how long are you doing, 20?
Yeah, just 20, yeah. It's that thing of, you know what it's like when you double, you sort of lose.
Just 20? That's an hour and 40 minutes. That's more than...
A lot of performing. And you sort of forget where you are.
Like, yeah, exactly.
The 99 Club doubles in central London where you sort of run between, you know, like around Piccadilly area between gigs. And by the end, you're just sort of like, you don't know who's in the front row. You don't know who you've talked to. You think like, you're a lawyer, aren't you? I'm like, no, that was two gigs ago. Like, completely lost track of what you're doing.
One of the things that I romanticised about the early days of Edinburgh was that, you know, when I started, there weren't like loads of clubs in London. So you could maybe gig once every 2 weeks. But by the time you got to the second gig, 2 weeks later, all of your nerves came back. So you were too nervous to have learned anything from your first gig. So when you go up to Edinburgh and you're doing like the Free Fringe or whatever, and you end up doing like 5, 6, 7 gigs a day and you're running all over the place, in my head, I'm like very romantic about the fact that it's like, oh God, you could do a month's worth of gigs in a week, you know?
Yeah.
And it was so wonderful. But I also remember like, my quality control really slipping by the end of the day. And I would be like, well, they must know I'm knackered, right? I've done 7 gigs. What's your name, mate? Yeah, brilliant. You know, like real shit stuff.
I quite like how relaxed you can be in Edinburgh doing those gigs and how you'll just like, someone will disappear for half an hour and you won't know where they've gone. They've gone, just did a gig. We've just walked somewhere. You just leave a group, wander off somewhere, do a gig, come back to the group. And I like that. It's nice. It's kind of like, oh, yeah, just did it. Very casual. No one thinks about it.
Nick, you're totally right about the more gigs you do, the less you care about the that audience. And you sort of walk off going, oh, I did a bad job there. Those 100 people don't like me.
Yeah.
But then I think I care less.
Who gives a fuck? I've got another gig now and I'm going to be twice as bad. I think that's a really important thing to go through.
Yes.
It's good to get to a point in Edinburgh when you're gigging so much that you're not overthinking all the gigs and thinking them all as like precious little diamonds, and you kind of like go, all right, so where are we? And it also allows you to kind of like go, well, I could do my material, I know that works, but what are we doing in this room particularly?
Yeah.
What can we say about this audience, and what can, and it actually forces you, or not even forces you, it gives you the confidence to kind of sort of be the comedian that you would be if you weren't constrained with a waiting list and lack of audience.
Yeah, you're really good at that. You're really good at like being in the room and making a whole thing out of the room. I can do it for like a few minutes and then I go, oh God, okay, let's go back to the jokes now.
Well, I think it's because I don't have jokes. So I'm forced to. If I had the jokes, then I would
definitely
rely on them.
Doing Edinburgh, I think, is the best thing in the world. When you're starting out and, as you say, you're not doing as many gigs in London or wherever you live, and then you go to Edinburgh and suddenly you do 60 in a month or whatever it is. And I remember the first Edinburgh I did Free Fringe, 11 p.m. at night, every night. It was a triple header, so it was three of us, and all did 15, 20 minutes. And every night I watched a lad called Red Redmond, lovely guy. I watched him do, in a leotard, oil himself up and dance to the Beyonce Single Ladies song. And that was how we closed every single show. And you learn a lot from that as a performer. You learn watching that and seeing reactions. And you also, when people walk out and go, wow, that red guy smashed it. And you have to really look at yourself and think, well, what am I doing? Am I doing enough?
I used to think, because that was the thing, wasn't it? People would do gigs in Edinburgh as a way to promote their own shows. And you'd go somewhere at like 11:30, and there'd be three people in the audience, and you go, you're not coming.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm here. But the idea is always this idea that it's promotion, isn't it, for your own show. It's promotion. And then you're going, I'm only going to be doing a bit more of what I've done now.
Yeah.
Do a bit of, I'm going to give you a little bit, and you can see a bit more of that if you want. But you're also like, I don't want you to come, and none of you are even coming.
And then there's the heart-wrenching moment when you give out flyers at the end and none of them take them. And you're like,
yeah, fuck them. I gave someone a flyer in 2010, and they said, and I'd just done my act with singing and poetry and, you know, audience participation, all this stuff. And I just done my, and on the way out, they said, oh, you're like Justin Lee Collins. So I took my flyer back and I don't want you to come. If you can't tell the difference between what I just did and reuniting the A-team, then it's like, what's the fucking point, you know? Don't fucking come to my fucking show. Fucking hell, you're making
me
angry.
That person was the commissioner of Channel 4, and it was a shame.
It was. This was in like 2011. It was 10 years ago, but it wasn't 30 years ago. And I did a gig in London, and there was a commissioner from a channel there, and he saw my act, and he came up to me afterwards and he said, have you ever thought about doing character comedy? And I said, well, in a way, that's kind of, it's kind of what I do. And he went, good. Because I'm always on the lookout for the next Stavros, right? And I'm like, Stavros, right? It's 2011 or 12, right? We're on the lookout for the next Stavros, Harry Enfield Stavros from 1984. You're on the lookout for the next Stavros. It's like if he'd have said Ali G,
you've been looking for ages.
Ali G, it would have been a dated reference, but it would have been like, yeah, I know what you mean. But Stavros was just like, what? And he was in charge. Do you know what I mean? He was the main guy that was on the lookout for the next Stavros.
I'm looking. I'm still looking. He's still out.
I'm looking for the next Stavros. Sure, mate. You've just seen a character. Well, I'm not a character comedian, but you've just said, have you ever thought about doing character comedy? It's just like, oh, fucking hell. That was just me up there, mate. Fucking hell. Absolutely. Anyway, it's great. It's great that you've had your crack of the whip. And,
but like a sitcom genuinely is like the holy grail, isn't it? Of things you would like to have done.
Yeah.
Does that feel like that's up there?
It does. It feels incredible. And it actually is just a huge relief. It's just sort of like, oh, God, done it. Like, I've done the thing I was aiming to do. And, like, not that I want to quit or anything. It's just like, ah, oh, it does take a bit of the pressure off. I'm just sort of, oh, I've done the thing. I worked really hard on that. And that's achieved now. And also, if anyone says, when I'm older and I have to become an Uber driver or something, and someone says, oh, you did comedy, did you? I'm like, yeah, no, I wrote a sitcom. I'm like, don't look at the don't read about it. Just know that it did happen, and that's I achieved something from those 10 years of working hard.
And do you know anything about a second series or anything like that yet?
No, we don't know yet, but we're hopeful. I mean, if ITV have backed it so much, they've put it everywhere. They've bloody spent a fortune on adverts, so they must think it's all right. It's doing really well on the hub and stuff. It's like the most popular thing on the hub, which is really nice. Which I don't know how many people watch ITV Hub, but however many are on there, a lot of them are watching Buffering. It might be a really small number, but they're watching it.
Just for our listeners, Steve, just explain to the people at home what ITV Hub is.
It's like iPlayer, yeah, but less efficient.
That's exactly what I was. I knew that's what I. That's the way I'd have said it.
Yeah,
and more for, a bit like that.
It's very. Is it more for? Or is it all for these days? They've changed.
All for.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
No, I said more for, but what's just again? More what's for. The difference between more for and all for the people at home?
More for was a channel, wasn't it? Does that still exist?
I don't know.
It's a good name, though.
Whatever it is, it's all great. More for sounds a little bit like awful.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
All for. I'd say ITV Hub isn't quite as good as All Four in terms of the range of shows it's got on there, but it works. It works.
Works.
And it, you can watch Buffering
on
there.
And I should say, you can see all of it.
Oh, yeah, that's crucial.
Yeah,
it goes out on TV every Thursday at 10, which is nice. You know, straight after Love Island, you've got a nice captive audience there. But actually, I think the best way to watch it is just to binge it on the hub. It's very bingeable. It's cliffhangers and stuff. And just takes about 2 hours, I reckon. 2 hours, 10 to watch the whole thing. Just do that.
Binge it on the hub, the 22. It sounds like we're wrapping up, but we're really just ramping up. Because now we're going to just binge it on the hub. It's 22 minutes an episode. If you watch it on the hub, they cut out the adverts as well, right? So you just go straight.
Less adverts. Yeah. Yeah.
Can I just ask, this is a bit of a selfish personal question, but how long is the script if you're writing 22 minute episodes?
Well, physically, how long is it?
How many pages? 20,
I think they were all about 24, 25.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah, great. And do you write an ad break in there, or do they do it?
That we do it at the end. Yeah. And we do put break. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I'll apply that to. I need to cut. I need to make some cuts.
Are you great. Working now?
What are you talking about? And so. Right, so speaking of sitcoms, do we want to talk about... have you got any favourite films? Do you like films?
Yeah, well, I've got loads, obviously, but I was thinking recently, have you seen Promising Young Woman?
I haven't seen it.
No, is it good?
The new Carey Mulligan film. It's honestly brilliant. It's, like, incredible. I watched it, I thought, oh, that might be the best film I've watched maybe in years. Sure. Written by Emerald Fennell, who is in... The Crown and played the
Camilla,
yeah, and she's also the sister of John Robbins's wife. So there's a lot of connections. And
I love if that'd be the first thing you'd say to her. Yeah. Wait.
Oh, John Robbins. John Robbins, your brother-in-law, right? And she's like, oh, I've got an Oscar. I'm like, no, you know John Robbins. Anyway, it's brilliant, and it's about a woman who basically tries to avenge her friend's sexual assault. By sort of tricking men into thinking that she's more drunk than she is, and they kind of try and take advantage, and then she sort of wakes up and gives them the fright of their life.
I thought it was more of a revenge film. I thought the trailer made it look like she's on some sort of killing spree, but that isn't my understanding of what the film is at all.
It's a kind of justice. She's trying to get justice and right the wrongs. And she's after one particular guy who hurt her friend. Yeah, it's brilliant. It's just brilliant. And it's got the most fantastic ending. And you can sort of feel good about yourself for watching it, because it's quite a big topic that we all need to feel bad about, you know? Yeah. So just by watching it, that helps.
Right.
It helps. That's good. It does look really good. The thing that really throws me, I'm just looking her up. Do you remember Bonnie Hunt?
Yeah, I know Bonnie Hunt.
From the Cheaper by the Dozen movies, and she's sort of like an American comedian. Carey Mulligan looks so much like mid-90s Bonnie Hunt in the trailer for Promising Young Woman.
I'm going to have a look.
For a while, I was just like, it's Bonnie Hunt in Promising Young Woman. And then it was like, no, because Cheaper by the Dozen was fucking...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she does look
like 20 years ago was Cheaper by the Dozen. They don't make movies like that. Fuck me. Right, Promising Young Woman. Great. What else do you like?
What have I been watching recently? I'll tell you what I binged. This isn't a film. This is a TV series.
Yeah.
It's a bit trashy, I guess you might call it. But Friday Night Lights, the American high school, American football like drama.
Hang on. I'm thinking immediately of Any Given Sunday starring Al Pacino. It's not that. What's Friday Night Lights? Was that a film as well? That is a film.
It is a film, but that's not the thing. It got turned into a film afterwards, but that's not the good element of it.
Hang on, it was a series and then it was a film?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, that was the order they did it.
Do you think?
No, it definitely was.
Was it a film and then a series?
I don't know. Do we need to look this up? I think the series was in 2008.
Anyone famous in the series?
Carl Chandler.
Okay.
Connie Britton. And Taylor Kitsch is pretty famous.
Taylor Kitsch, was he in...
John Carter, Warlord of Mars.
John Carter of Mars.
Oh, and it says here the film first came out in 2004. So maybe it was a film turned into a TV.
I think it would be fucking bonkers, Steve, if they made a TV series and then they went, you know what, let's make a movie. I think, unless it's Transformers.
But that's happened loads of times. Think of the In-Betweeners movie. And Bad Education, the movie.
I suppose, yeah.
What do you know Bad Education and In-Betweeners for being there?
Sitcoms.
Yeah. I mean, they're TV. They're, like, the film was like, we've done a... We can get the cast back for...
Yeah, a little cash cow.
Although it's like the In-Betweeners movies are the biggest British movies of all time, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Anyway, Friday Night Lights, it's fantastic. It's just, the characters are brilliant. Everyone's really beautiful, you know, and they just play football. And it doesn't matter that I don't really know anything about American football. I can sort of live out my fantasy of being the cool kid at school through these cool kids. And I feel seen, you know.
Were there shows that you had in mind when you were writing Buffering? Like, did you have like almost like a mood board of things? It's like, we want it to be like that. We don't want it to be like that.
Yeah.
We want it to be. What were you thinking of when you were writing?
Back to Buffering.
Yeah. But it's related to what we're talking about.
Oh, all right. Okay.
Can't get away from it, Nick. Got to keep pushing it.
Got to keep pushing it.
I'm just trying to hit some format points.
We're doing both.
Sure. All right.
No, there were things we had. We were keen for it to have some heart and some a bit more seriousness to it than maybe you'd expect from ITV2 sitcom. So it has got a little bit of quite a lot of pathos in it, I guess. But in terms of pacing, we wanted it to be like an American sitcom with like three stories in it. Like, sort of basically, I was obsessed with Modern Family, I think, when I first formatted Buffering. So I was obsessed with the sort of ABC, really fast paced, set them up and then just bang through the stories. Yeah, so I think it's got that kind of pacing feel to it, but then maybe slightly more heart than... Although Modern Family's got quite a lot of pathos in it. That's what we sort of modelled it on.
So in terms of actually sitting down and doing the typing, who's sitting down doing the typing?
I usually typed. Ian would pace around.
Ian paces around and shouts out ideas.
Just shouts out words. we did a lot of it on Zoom because a lot of it was written during the pandemic. So I'd be typing on my screen. I'd share the screen and he would, you know, we'd say, oh, how do you make this line funnier? But also a lot of it was just with a whiteboard and trying to work out the beats and all that stuff and trying to make it all to, you know, the actual scripting bit was probably the least intensive bit. It was trying to get all the stories to match up. And that was just a slow process of sitting in a room going mad.
But it's fun when it clicks, isn't it?
Oh, it's the best feeling. And when you realise something's going to work. Also, you have that thing of, you have a really good day of writing and you think, oh my God, I've done it. We've clicked that. And then the next day you look at it and go, that doesn't make any fucking sense. What was I thinking? And you go back to square one. But that is the best feeling. And that's why I desperately want a second series, because I just want to have that. I want some structure in my life again. You know, I just want to have fulfillment.
I was saying to Nat that I've done a lot of, before, I think before we were even recording, I was saying I've done a lot of first series. And I think everything should automatically get a second series.
Yeah.
Maybe not everything, but everything I've done should automatically get a second series. Because you learn so much from the first series that I think that if you... There's so much working out that's still visible. Like, even we've been talking for the last 3 weeks about the Mission Impossible movies, and it's only about the third or the fourth film where they actually get the formula right.
Yeah.
The first two are just sort of like, how about this? How about this? And they go, no, we kind of got it. I think it's the fourth film where they've gone, let's do them like this.
Yeah. And well, I went, you know, Parks and Rec. I once went to a talk by Greg Daniels, who's like the showrunner on that, and The Office, and various other big shows. And, he basically said that Parks and Rec, first series, was kind of like, oh, they looked at it and went, oh, we got that wrong. And then they fixed it. So second series onwards, they basically changed the main character, Leslie Knope, and made her slightly more likable, basically. And it transformed the whole sitcom. Not that it wasn't bad in the first series, but it wasn't, you know, what it could have been. And then it became one of the biggest sitcoms ever. And it's like, if they never got that chance to... Yeah. And that was with 24 episodes they would have done, I think, of that first series. So, yeah, I agree. I definitely
agree. Also, famously with British comedy, you've got stuff like Blackadder and the first series. It's not unwatchable, but it's not an easy watch. Mm. It's kind of irritating. And then when you get to the second series, you go, oh, it all clicks and it's all brilliant. And then they just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine where they'd be if you're able to do Big Baby series two. Imagine what you would have done in that.
Well, I had very little control over that and... I don't know why
it shows.
No, I don't know why it didn't get a second series, but it certainly wasn't because Major Mustache wasn't pulling his weight. But that's all I have to say about that. We're in a dangerous territory now because we've got 6 minutes left of the show. We've got a game to play.
We do,
but we really haven't found out anything about our guest.
No, so.
Oh. I feel like I've given away quite a lot. Have I been?
No,
you're.
It's not your fault, Steve. It's not your.
I mean, your favorite. What's your favorite sitcom?
Favorite sitcom is British sitcom is Gavin and Stacey, and American sitcom is The US Office. Very basic choices, but
Gavin and Stacey, US Office. And your favorite film stars Taylor Kitsch. I think we can all.
No, the film isn't...
Identify with that.
The film is Promising Young Woman. Let's go with that one.
Promising Young Woman and that Al Pacino TV series about baseball. So, now we know you. I think that what we should possibly be doing now is working out a format of... our guests should try and impress us with what they're into, and then at the end we can let them into the clubhouse or not.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's better.
And then the final test, that's better, right?
This is like the second series. This is when you work out the second series.
Yeah, and Steve knows. He's got a fucking sitcom.
Yeah, but they don't do that on air.
We do. We're doing it. This is for the noughties, mate. We're doing iPods for the noughties, all right?
Right.
So, right, all okay. Right, that filled some time. Let's play the game.
What's the game?
The game is called...
What's the game? It's the internationally famous game Better or Worse. And for that, I'm unfortunately going to have to hand you over to my esteemed colleague, Nathaniel George Metcalf.
Nathaniel, hey, Steve, the game is called Better or Worse. And you have to say whether the next person on the list is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my opinions to score points.
Okay.
Okay, beginning with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Is Eamon Holmes better or worse than Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Worse, definitely worse.
Worse. Is Sherlock Holmes better or worse than Eamon Holmes?
Better, definitely better.
Better.
Not even real.
Is Katie Holmes better or worse than Sherlock Holmes?
Worse.
Worse. Is Katy Perry better or worse than Katie Holmes?
Ooh, that's a tough one.
I think.
I can only go on what I think of Katy Perry, and I think she seems lovely.
She seems nice. Do you not like Katie Holmes?
I don't have very strong opinions on Katie Holmes, and I'm sorry for that.
Hang on. I'm thinking of Katie Hopkins.
No. Katie Holmes.
It's Katie Holmes from Batman Begins.
You betcha.
I'm going to say, I feel like, okay, I would personally say Katie Brady's better, but I'm judging you, Nathaniel, and I'm going to say you think she's worse.
I think she's worse, but she seems nice, like you say, but I think she's worse.
Yeah.
Matthew Perry, better or worse than Katy Perry?
Definitely better.
Better.
Not in the head.
Sure.
Maybe doesn't seem so well, but... but
well, let's not judge people on this show, Steve. Come on.
That's true, actually, Nick. Can I take that back?
we can maybe edit
Fortunately, unfortunately, it's going out live, so carry on.
I mean, he's one of my favourite sitcom characters ever.
Let's stop this chatter. Let's keep going.
Matthew Broderick, better or worse than Matthew Perry?
Worse, because I think Matthew Perry's brilliant. Just want to say that.
I think Broderick's better. I like Perry. I think Broderick's
better. Up until now, I've got every single one right.
Yeah, you bet.
Yeah.
Matthew McConaughey, better or worse than Matthew Broderick?
Worse. He's an odd man, McConaughey.
I think he's better. I like them both, but I think it's climbing. Matt LeBlanc, better or worse than Matthew McConaughey?
Better. Much better.
Better. I would say better. You're worse. Right. Say, you're worse. You're wrong. Nathaniel, you're so wrong. At that reunion, Matt LeBlanc was like...
Didn't watch it.
He was the best.
Okay, I've heard some... Well,
fuck me. Matt LeBlanc is fucking... He's the best.
Also, Matt LeBlanc has done such great... He's done Top Gear. He's the biggest sitcom in the world, and he presented Top Gear.
Yeah. He's in Friends, and he's the only person that kind of like turned up to the Friends reunion and was like, I remember every episode and I remember making them. And everyone else is kind of like, we did Friends. Yeah, but we're movie stars now. And he's like, nah, I've done Friends. And now I'm free to do Top Gear if I want.
And he was like, I still watch it.
I watch it with my daughters. I love it. I loved him. Go on. Right.
Matt Damon, better or worse than Matt LeBlanc?
Worse. And if you disagree with me, you're wrong.
Worse.
Better.
No.
Damon Hill, better or worse than Matt Damon?
At racing, better.
Well, not at racing, as a human being.
Better. Well, I think racing's one of my biggest ways of judging people, so better.
He's worse. Damon Hill, boring man.
Worse.
Five. It can't be five, can it?
It can't be five. He was on the line for getting 10 out of 10 until he got five wrong.
Four.
Is that how... Is five
Quick,
how many...
I think he might be five.
Less than a minute! Come on! What is it? Is it five?
They say it's five.
Five.
I got more than
five. It's five, apparently.
Well, I'm sorry, Steve. You got five, which means that you're not as good as Helen Ledrow with 10. Dame Baptiste and Marina Sirtis with 9. Bash from Massive Raggers with 8. Jamie Adams, Carl Gass, and Izzy Sooty with 6.
I didn't get 5.
You are as good as Sarah Gibson, Laura Jean Marsh with 5, which means that you are not even... I mean, you're bang.
I didn't get 5. I want a recount on that. I did not get 5.
You can't get a recount. You can't get a recount. I'm sorry. It's terrible. Steve, thank you for coming on the show. Welcome to the club.
I'm sorry it ended like this.
Congratulations. I'm sorry we didn't get to know you in any way whatsoever. You're welcome back anytime you want. Good luck with getting a series 2. Well done with the sitcom.
Thanks for having me.
Have a wonderful afternoon.
Sort your game out, though. Look at a restructure of that game. It's an absolute farce.
Listen, right. You do not get to come on our show and talk this absolute bullshit. Thank God we stopped recording, but this is the first guest I've ever had to fucking reprimand. And thanks everyone for listening. It's been lovely to spend another 2 hours with you. Good luck with all your lives and see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.